Chapter 2, Revelations. Promptly, at 8 o'clock, we entered the library and found that Daniel Rayburn had preceded us. He went straight to the matter in hand. At 2 o'clock today, he began, I received information that the men had made a rich strike at the mine in Colorado, and I have sent Gray on ahead. Day after tomorrow, I must join him. I would like all of you to come with me. Nada will be comfortable in the bungalow at the camp, and you two can stay with me in the mine. I have something else to tell you that is both grave and strange. At 4 o'clock this morning, I was awakened by a presence in my room, and when I became fully aroused, I saw it was our beloved Saint Germain. He talked to me for at least 2 hours, and among other things said that Gray had attempted to take my life last night. He saw the intent, and at the moment Gray tried to fire, Saint Germain directed a flash of electronic force that knocked him senseless for the time being. He has been warned that if he makes another such attempt, his own destructive motive will be permitted to react instantly, and his own body will pay the penalty. Then I told them of my experience the night of my arrival, and how I had witnessed the whole affair. Rayburn was deeply moved, and rising to his feet he extended his hand to me, saying, You are surely one of us, and I am deeply, deeply grateful. Saint Germain said you had been brought into our home because you were greatly needed, and that from now on you would act in the capacity of elder brother to Nada and Rex. It seems we have known each other in a number of previous embodiments. He also told me that none of us was to be concerned in the least about danger of any kind, for we have lived clean lives and held close to high ideals. This, it seems, from the Ascended Master's standpoint, makes it possible to wield a mighty force for the protection of all. Saint Germain also instructed me regarding other things of importance. He explained to me the activity one experiences after he has made the ascension. Jesus gave the public an example of this, and sought to teach mankind its meaning, pointing everyone to that same attainment. I am, before long, to enter this great freedom. Our beloved Master made it very clear that one is sometimes raised into this condition, previous to or near the change called death, but all must accomplish it from the physical side of life. If the silver cord of light flowing into the body has been withdrawn, it is impossible to illumine and raise that body, and the one thus striving must re-embody once more in order to attain the final freedom from the physical side of human experience. All ascensions must take place consciously, for this ascended master attainment is the complete victory over all outer experiences through the personal self. I shall read you his own words, which I took down at his direction. Turning to a portfolio which lay upon his desk, he opened it and read. So-called death is but an opportunity for rest and reattunement of the faculties of the personal consciousness. This is to free them from the turmoil and discords of earth, long enough to receive an inflow of light and strength that will enable the outer activity of the mind to take up the work of physical experience again. Physical embodiment is for the purpose of preparing, perfecting, and illumining a body which can be raised to blend with the body of the mighty I Am Presence. We call it the Magic Presence. Jesus referred to it as the seamless garment. In this body, which is made of pure electronic substance, the individual has complete freedom from all limitation. And through intense devotion to the mighty I Am Presence, anyone can release its power to the point where he can see this blazing body of substance, so dazzling that at first one can only gaze upon it for an instant because of the intensity of its light. Through such devotion, one begins to manifest more and more of his own individual, conscious dominion over all manifestation. This is everyone's eternal birthright, and the purpose for which all decreed the journey through human experience. When the one striving for such freedom has reached the point where he releases any amount of light he desires from his electronic body instantly by his own conscious command, then he can control all manifestation, no matter in what sphere he may choose to express. One has but to observe the world at large to see what discord in thought and feeling does to the beautiful bodies that nature provides for our experience in the physical part of life. In childhood and youth, the flesh structure of the physical body is beautiful, strong, and responsive to the demands made upon it. But when discordant thoughts and feelings are allowed to express in the personal self over the years, as one goes through life, the body becomes incapacitated, and the temple falls into ruins, because the outer waking consciousness does not obey the one law of life, love, harmony, and peace. Call it what you will, the eternal truth remains, that discord is another name for disintegration, a synonym for death. When mankind learns to live its life by the one eternal law of love, it will find that such obedience will have released it from the wheel of birth and rebirth, and hence the problems of human existence will have disappeared. In their place will come the joy of ever expanding the perfection which forever abides within love. Constant new creation will ever go on, for life is perpetual motion, and neither slumbers nor sleeps, but is ever and forever a self-sustained stream of expanding perfection in joy, in ecstasy, and in eternally new design. This perfect activity and joy of life are all contained within obedience to the law of love. The last enemy, death, will have disappeared, for it is but a means of release from a garment that no longer has anything of value to give for the use of the perfection of life. When the physical body is so incapacitated that the personality occupying it can no longer make self-conscious effort to express perfection, then nature herself takes a hand in things and dissolves the limitation that the individual may have a new chance to make effort that is of benefit. Grief for the death of a loved one is selfishness, and but retards the greater good the loved one should be enjoying. Grief from a sense of loss is really rebellion against the action of a law that has seen fit to give another greater opportunity for rest and growth, because nothing in the universe goes backward, and all, no matter what the temporary appearance, is moving forward to greater and greater joy and perfection. The God consciousness in us cannot and does not grieve, and the human part should know that as no one can ever get out of this universe, he must be somewhere that is better than the place he left. If there is real, true, divine love, it can never cease to exist, and must sometime, somewhere draw us to that which we love. In true divine love, there is no such thing as separation, and that which feels a sense of separation is not love. A sense of separation is merely one of the mistakes of the personal self, which it continues to dwell in, because it does not understand the nature of consciousness. Where the consciousness is, there the individual is functioning, for the individual is his consciousness. When one thinks of a loved one who has passed on, he is really with that loved one in his higher mental body, the moment his consciousness is upon the other person. If the Western world could understand this truth, it would lift the chains that cause such useless suffering. Such grief is all due to the fact that the personality, especially in the feelings, accepts the body as being the individual, instead of knowing that the body is only a garment which the individual wears. Over it, everyone should have complete and eternal dominion, and should exact perfect obedience at all times. If one really loves another, He wants that other to be happy and harmonious. If, through so-called death, an individual choose to accept a better chance for future expression, if there be the slightest spark of love, one should have no grief, nor desire to hold that loved one in a state of incapacity, when he might go on to greater ease and freedom. It is the ignorance of this truth that enables such selfishness to keep humanity bound in its self-created chains of limitation. This sort of ignorance binds the life expression of the whole race, and is a stubborn refusal to understand life. It drags thousands of human beings every year into the depths of despair, wholly unnecessary and avoidable, when they could and should be enjoying happiness and living the way the mighty I Am Presence intended them to live. Such an attitude toward life not only prevents the accomplishment of everything worthwhile, but incapacitates the individual and fills him with self-pity, one of the most subtle and insidious ways by which the senator force breaks down his resistance and makes him negative. The individual must remain positive if he is to attain his victory and express mastery. The senator force that humanity on this earth has generated uses this method to keep aspiring, marvelous individuals from gaining their freedom and using the full power of divinity, which has been theirs from the beginning, the gift of the Father to his children. Of all the faults humanity has generated, self-pity is the most inexcusable, because it is the apex of human selfishness. Through self-pity, the attention of the personal consciousness or outer self is entirely absorbed by the petty, puny, human useless desires of the physical body, and the great, glorious, adorable, all-wise, all-powerful light of the mighty I Am Presence, always abiding above the physical body, is entirely ignored. Yet its energy is being used for this destructive purpose. Humanity cannot have anything better than it is experiencing today, until it looks away from the little self long enough to acknowledge and feel the presence of God, the mighty I Am Presence, the source of every individual's life and of all perfect manifestation. Grief is colossal selfishness, not love. Discord is selfishness, not love. Lethargy is selfishness, not love and not life. These sink the race into slavery, because they break down the resistance of the individual by wasting the energy of life which should be used for the creation of beauty, love, and perfection. This slavery continues because the outer activity of the personal consciousness does not make the necessary determined effort to free itself from the domination of the psychic world. The psychic stratum contains only those creations of humanity generated by the discordant thoughts, feelings, and words of the outer activity, or personal consciousness. This means the daily activities of the mind and body, with which the personality continues to entangle the creative expression of life. The entire race has become so bound by its own discord that great, glorious, transcendent, ascended masters, out of sheer compassion for the slowness of mankind's growth and the misery of its degradation, offer to cut away the barnacles of the psychic plane and give humanity a new start. People are entertained, fascinated, and self-hypnotized by the various conditions of the psychic world, but I tell you, and I know both the inner and outer activities of life from the Ascended Master's standpoint, that there is nothing good nor permanent within the psychic stratum. It is as dangerous as quicksand and just as undependable. The psychic plane and the outer activity of the mental and emotional world, unless it reports perfection to you, are one and the same thing. It is entirely the creation of the human sense consciousness and is but the accumulation of human thoughts and forms energized by human feelings. It contained nothing whatsoever of the Christ, the cosmic light. The desire for and fascination of psychic phenomena is a feeling, a very subtle feeling, by which it holds the attention of the personality away from the acknowledgement, the constant adoration, the continual communion, and the permanent acceptance of the individual's mighty I Am presence. Attention to the activities of the psychic plane depletes the personal self of the energy and the ability required to reach to the God source and anchor there permanently. I tell you eternal truth when I say that nothing of the Christ comes from the psychic realm, regardless of any seeming evidence to the contrary, because the psychic or outer activity of the mentality is forever changing its qualities, while the Christ, which is the eternal light, is ever-expanding perfection, the one changelessly supreme imperishable quality. It is because of the attention to and the subtle fascination of the psychic plane that mankind is today as a mass of children needing much help and the wisdom of the ascended masters to raise them once more into the understanding of the light, which is the only means of release from the darkness of Earth's present chaos. World saviors have come at regular intervals to give this kind of help throughout the centuries, ever since the end of the second golden age upon this earth. Following that activity, humanity became fascinated by the world of form and the creation of things. The individual's attention was held most of the time in the outer activities, and the conscious recognition of his own individualized God self was forgotten. Hence the mighty I Am presence abiding in his electronic body was completely ignored. Thus, he has only been able to express part of his life plan. Saint Germain asked that you, my brother, continued Rayborn, turning to me, watch your feelings and impressions very closely while you are in and at the mine, for work of a certain nature is to be done there now or never. He wishes to utilize a certain cosmic activity occurring at this time for reasons he did not give me. He said he would come again very soon and speak with us all. He will then endeavor to give further light on the Cave of Symbols that you visited recently, and to which we shall all go with him on his next visit. Gray will pass on very shortly from natural causes, and I am not to let him suspect that I know anything of his attempt on my life. The tales of the Arabian Nights were hardly stranger than the truths we were receiving, and the wonderful things we were experiencing. It seemed as if we had entered another world where the activity of the mind became instantly manifest in physical form. Saint Germain had shown such conclusive evidence that he knew every incident and activity of our lives when he desired to do so, and even saw the innermost thoughts and intents of each of us. I felt a tremendous uplift and a happiness unspeakable. At first, Nada and Rex were inclined to be sad when they realized the parting with their father was to come so soon. But I knew positively that they would be sustained by the one great presence of the I Am when the time came. I asked Nada and Rex, as we passed out of the library, if they would sing a song or two for their new brother, and they laughingly agreed. They sang Love's Light Eternal, for which Nada had written the music and Rex the lyrics. The melody and power of it seemed to linger and continue to lift one's consciousness to the great creator of all things, the mighty I Am presence. As we stood together, when they had finished singing, I put my arms around both the children, led them over to their father, and we formed a circle about him. Beloved brother, I said, we encircle you with hearts of love, and may the pathway of each be that of supreme happiness through the radiant power of divine love within us all. I told them Our words failed utterly to express my joy and gratitude for their love, friendship, and hospitality. "My brother," said Daniel Rayborn, "it is I who wish to express my gratitude to Saint Germain and you for the privilege of your friendship, that my beloved children may have you as a companion when I am elsewhere serving in my humble way. Let us rejoice in the happiness we can give each other. I think we had better get all the rest we can tonight and tomorrow, as we are driving to the mine in Colorado, and we ought to leave early the following morning." The next morning at breakfast, after a wonderful night's rest, Daniel Rayborn greeted us by saying that he had found a message from Saint Germain on the table as he awakened, asking the four of us to meet in the tower room at 8 o'clock that evening. Needless to say, we were all interested in a moment and joyous for the anticipation of his coming. At 8:20, Daniel Rayborn announced it was time to go to the tower room for our meeting. But somehow, I felt temporarily restrained from doing it. When we came to the door, he stood still before it a few moments, as though in meditation. Presently, the door slowly opened without anyone touching it, and as we entered, I saw it was richly carpeted and handsomely furnished. In the center of the gorgeous blue carpet, there had been woven the secret, sacred symbol of life, upon which our beloved Saint Germain produced a life-giving and consuming flame. The walls were covered with a glistening white material that looked like frosted silk. Chairs were unlike anything I have ever seen. They were made of some kind of white metal, resembling frosted silver, upholstered in silk plush of the same rich blue as the carpet, and so perfectly designed as to give the body ease, poise, and balance when seated in them. There was a chair placed at each of the four points of the compass, forming a square within the circle of the room. The two windows and the door locked from the inside. When all were in readiness, Daniel Rayborn asked each of us to close our eyes and remain perfectly calm and silent until Saint Germain appeared and spoke. In a few moments a deep, rich voice said, "I bring you greetings, my beloved students." I opened my eyes, and there was the blessed, wonderful presence of our beloved master. He stood fully 6'1" in height, slender, royal, and real. His hair was dark brown, wavy, and abundant. His face portrayed a beauty, majesty, and power no words can describe. A face revealing eternal youth, with eyes of the deepest violet one can imagine, through which the wisdom of the ages poured out upon the world, expressing the love and mastery that are his. He stepped across the room to where Nada sat, bowed and touched her forehead with the thumb of his right hand, the fingers extending over the top of her head. He did the same thing to Rex, myself, and Daniel Rayborn. It is in this way that an ascended master can give a radiation which does for the individual what nothing else can do. It is a tremendous aid in clearing the mind, for it releases certain higher activities from within the student's inner bodies while he is within the master's aura. "Beloved ones," he began, "this evening I have come to explain certain laws that will enable you to manifest dominion over human limitation, once you know and fully understand the life principle within your human body. Then you will know and feel that it truly is all-wise and all-powerful. When you really comprehend this, you will see that it is not only natural and possible, but eventually compulsory, that you transcend all outer activity, its laws, and its limitations. These come into existence through ignorance and express in the outer activity because the intellect is allowed to act without the light from within the heart illumining it. Discord and limitation are imposed upon the outer activity by man and man alone, for an all-wise, all-perfect, all-powerful supreme creator does not and cannot create a limitation, a lack, or a discord. The concept that it is possible for all perfection to create imperfection or anything unlike itself is absurd, vicious, and entirely untrue. The Supreme Creator gives to the individual with free will the use of the attributes of the Creator with which to manipulate manifestation at his particular point in the universe. The individual is endowed with the capacity to form conclusions through using the intellect alone, which are the results of fragmentary information. It comes about from using only a part of the creative powers with which the individual is endowed. Conclusions drawn from partial instead of complete information must of necessity bring about unsatisfactory results. The individual must have free will, or he could not be a creator. If he choose to experiment with the spoke instead of the entire wheel, there is not to say him nay in his desire to experience those results. His wheel of manifestation cannot be and is not complete until he recognizes his mighty I Am presence, for it is the only source that knows all that is required to build any pattern of manifestation that produces perfection for him. All patterns of perfection are stored within the all-knowing, fathomless, dazzling mind of the mighty I Am presence, and can never be made manifest in the physical world of mankind until the outer activity of the mind, which is the intellectual consciousness, is illumined by the ray of golden light within the heart. This ray comes always and only from the electronic body of the individual. This is the magic presence, I Am. This mighty I Am presence of mankind's being does not cognize and never can create the maze of confusion, chaos, and destruction that exists in the outer mentality and world of humanity, any more than the sun creates a cloud. It is the birthright and privilege of every individual to express the fullness of this glorious inner presence and power of perfection. But if the personal self will not call the power of the presence into action through the higher mentality, into the outer activity at all times, then all outer experience merely remains the ever-changing condition or dumping ground of the thoughts and feelings of other human beings surrounding it. The presence of the mighty I Am abides within the electronic body of every individual, resting from 12 to 50 feet or more above the physical body, and is occupied only with creating, expanding, and forever pouring out perfection. It lives in its own realm, doing creative work at cosmic levels. Only in the outer activity of the human personality, which is but a fragmentary part of each one's individuality, can imperfection be generated and experienced. It is through the higher mentality that the discriminative and selective intelligence acts. In this body, the individualized intelligence can look upon the discords of human creation and observe the conditions by which the personality is surrounded and those it is passing through, but it does not accept them into its consciousness nor world. It sees what is required to produce perfection in the physical experience and can reach into the electronic body, the individual's mighty I Am presence, and draw forth that which produces perfection in the outer activity. In transcending all earthly laws, we but claim our God-given authority to live and act in perfect accord with the mighty I Am presence of man and infinity. This presence is eternal, changeless perfection, yet forever expanding itself through the individual. As you see, I come into your presence in a locked room with walls of solid stone. These seemingly impassable walls are no barrier or obstruction to the mighty I Am presence, any more than they are to an electrical impulse. This presence is the mighty master within, the God self of every individual. When one acknowledges, accepts, understands, and feels this mighty I Am presence, its limitless powers are released into his use. This home and room were dedicated to the ascended masters of love, light, and wisdom at the time the tower was built. and it will continue to be a focus for their activity as long as they desire to use it. When the shell, which means the discord of the outer self, is dissolved, not by passing through the change called death, but by consciously raising and illumining the body and its every activity by the light of the mighty I Am Presence, its power is released into the outer world through the individual, and he manifests complete mastery, the dominion that was given him in the beginning by the Father. Through his consciousness, every human being can release the limitless power of the mighty I Am Presence. When one disciplines his outer faculties and makes them obedient to his conscious command of perfection, he is then able to let this tremendous power flow through him unobstructed and use it constructively. Within each of you is this same mighty power that I am using. You can use it as I do when you acknowledge, accept, and admit at all times that the mighty I Am Presence is always in action. This is the cosmic Christ and the only consciousness in the universe that can say, I am. The thinking flame of God is the only activity of life anywhere in manifestation that can acknowledge its own individualization, use the creative word of God, and send it forth into the universe to cause manifestation. Only the Son of God, which means the individual with free will, can decree as God decrees and say, I am. Whatever quality follows that sound, spoken into the ethers, becomes a manifestation in the world of substance, and thus becomes a form. When the individual says, I am, he is using the creative attribute of the Godhead and announcing creation at his particular point in the universe. The vibratory action of the word I am, either in thought or spoken word, is the release of the power of creation, and whatever quality follows that decree is instantly imposed upon the electronic substance in the ethers. This being the only substance and energy in existence, whose nature is to be qualified in some manner, it must outpicture the pattern within the decree. If the decree is always for perfection, then the experiences in the individual's world express the fullness of the plan of life. But if the individual does not send forth that decree, it is impossible for that perfection to outpicture in his experiences until the decree is released into the ethers in which he lives. Every individual can think perfection at every instant if he only will, and it takes no more substance and energy to build a beautiful, perfect forms and experiences than it does the imperfect. But if the individual wants this perfection expressed in his own world, he must use his own energy to utter the decree, which will release that perfection unto him. Such is the law of his being, and nothing can change it. Life is the only presence, intelligence, and power that can act, or ever did act. These three activities within life are coexistent everywhere. The pure electronic light which fills infinity is the self-luminous, intelligent substance of the mighty I Am Presence, existing at all points, and of which all forms are composed. Discord and limitation can build a film, so to speak, around this substance, shutting off at least to some degree the radiance of its light. But imperfection of any kind can never enter in to the electronic substance itself. The discords and limitations that humanity has wound around itself are due to the activities of the intellect and the emotions, which have not been trained to look within the light of the individual's own mighty I Am Presence for the plan of perfection upon which each one should construct all his outer activities. This perfect plan does not exist anywhere except within the mighty I Am Presence. When the intellect and emotions are purified and illumined by the light of this great presence, then the perfect ideas and activities within it can flow through the personality without becoming distorted by the fragmentary information in the outer activity of the consciousness. The reports of the human sense consciousness are merely unillumined activities, for when light is directed into them from the mighty I Am Presence, they melt into its glorious perfection at once. Love, peace, balance, order, and perfect activity, or the coordination of all outer activities with the patterns of perfection from the Presence, can only be brought about by the one great light, the I Am. There and only there does the design of perfection ever exist. If the student or individual will fix his attention with determined tenacity and hold it upon the mighty I Am Presence, he can release such divine love, light, wisdom, power, courage, and activity as he cannot possibly comprehend at present. Divine love contains the perfect activity of every attribute of the Godhead. When the individual enters the conscious path of self-mastery, he should fully understand and realize that from then on he is obligated to accomplish everything he attempts by the power of divine love from within his own I Am Presence. He must know unmistakably and remember at all times that divine love contains within it the complete wisdom and almighty power of the mighty I Am Presence. When an individual generates enough divine love and sends it forth into all outer activities, he may command what he will through the mighty I Am Presence, and his request is always fulfilled. He may go among the wild beasts of the jungle, and no harm can come to him. Divine love, when consciously generated within the individual, is an invisible, invincible, and invulnerable armor of protection against all disturbing activity. There is only one thing that can bring about perfection anywhere in the universe, and that is enough divine love. Therefore, love your own mighty I Am Presence intensely, and nothing else can enter your being or world. You four beloved ones have come to the point where the I Am Presence commands the assistance of the Ascended Masters. Therefore, it will be my great pleasure to be of any help to you that may be required. Before I proceed further, I wish to convey the great love and blessing from your beloved mother and companion. Soon you will have the joy of seeing and greeting her face to face, and never again will you be disturbed by the thought or change called death. It gives me great joy to feel and see such wonderful harmony within your mental and emotional bodies. My brother, he said, turning to me, I welcome and bless you for so noble a nature, a sincere heart, and such great love. You will soon become aware that you have much to do besides your writing. Turning to Nada and Rex, he addressed them, My beloved Nada and Rex, I feel like both father and mother to you, although I cannot take the place of your earthly father who is so noble, so fine, and whose earthly pilgrimage is nearing its close. He may be with you many months yet. Please forget entirely that which you regard as separation, and enter fully in the activities before you. I am more than pleased, he continued, turning to me, to see in your heart a great willingness to serve wherever that service is most needed. That attribute will bring you very great light. Including all, he continued, after your trip to the mine, I will impart to each of you certain private instructions that will greatly assist and hasten the awakening of certain faculties whose use you will soon need, and through which I will be able to reach you much more easily. This will bring to you a clearness that bars all doubt. The superintendent at your mine, he said, speaking to Rayborn, will retain his physical body only until he can say a few parting words to you. North of the tunnel where the last strike was made, which has been considered very good, there is a deposit immensely richer that has been passed. I will indicate the place when you reach the exact spot in the tunnel. You are to mark it, he directed, glancing toward me. There are those in touch with Gray which makes it unwise to open this up until he is out of their reach. It will be much greater wisdom in the future to forbid any report going out of strikes made in the mine. This body of ore, which shall be indicated to you, contains over $20 million in gold, clear and above all operating expenses. Little do those of humanity who are in great need realize how easily and quickly they could and would be given their financial freedom if they would but turn their attention to the mighty I Am presence and hold it there with determined tenacity. Great would be their reward for such effort. I will be present while you are in the mine, but not visible to your outer sight. This is the re-establishing of our former wonderful association, and you will realize how beautiful it is when you become consciously aware of the tremendous power of the mighty I Am presence that is within and above each of you. This almighty power you will draw forth and use without limit. He gave each a hearty hand clasp and asked us to take the same position as before he came, saying we were all to meet again soon. When we opened our eyes a few moments later, he had disappeared as quickly as he had come. Nada and Rex said the experience was the most glorious of their lives and the happiest 2 hours they had ever spent thus far. Only a small part of such transcendent work can be conveyed in words to those who have not experienced these things. But all humanity may have the same opportunity when the individual is earnest, sincere, humble, and unselfish enough in his desire for the light, and really loves his own mighty I Am presence. It was so remarkable and uplifting to see the room brilliantly lighted by the radiant presence of Saint Germain. It was conclusive proof that his presence was its own light. Each of us experienced such peace and love as we never dreamed during existence. We could not refrain from embracing each other, and there were tears of joy in our eyes out of deep gratitude for such a divine privilege. We said good night and went to our rooms, as we were to leave early the following morning for the mine. We left very early, driving nearly 500 miles over a highway that was in splendid condition. The day was calm, bright, and lovely, the scenic beauty gorgeous. We took turns at the wheel, so no one was in the least tired, and at exactly 7 o'clock in the evening we drove into camp. We noticed a great deal of activity and excitement. As soon as the men saw us, one of them came running to the car, saying excitedly, "Gray has been badly hurt in the mine. It happened while we were changing shifts." Daniel Rayborn hurried away, while Rex and I took Nada to the bungalow. The men took care of the luggage, and we hurried to the superintendent's quarters, to which Gray had been carried. As we arrived, the room was being cleared of the men, as Gray wished to speak to Rayborn alone. We stepped in, greeted him, gave what encouragement we could, and then left the two alone. 30 minutes later, Rayborn came out. He was deeply moved, because, as he afterward told us, the man had made a full confession, asked forgiveness, and passed on immediately. Saint Germain, referring to it later, said, "The soul withdrew from its temple of flesh when it realized that the human self could not withstand the temptation." In shooting the hole drilled by the day shift, Rayborn explained, a large piece of rock became loosened. And as Gray was inspecting and sampling the day's work, the rock fell, striking him on the head. He dropped unconscious, and another piece fell upon his chest, crushing him so badly that there was no hope of recovery. He remained conscious until I reached his side. and made a full confession concerning his attempt upon my life, knowing he could not live. I gladly and freely forgave all that he might pass on in freedom. His soul can thus have its greatest opportunity for growth. His gratitude was unspeakable for the opportunity to free his conscience and be forgiven. His passing was really in very great peace. We were all rather stunned by the suddenness and accuracy with which Saint Germain's statements were being fulfilled. At 11 o'clock the next morning, a short service was held in camp, and the body then taken to the railway station, some 3 miles away. Bob Singleton accompanied it to San Francisco, where Gray's mother and brother lived. Mr. Rayburn sent them a check for $25,000 and paid all expenses. In all my mining experience, I have never seen so marvelous a camp of men as Rayburn employed. Everything possible had been done for their comfort and convenience, no intoxicating drinks of any kind ever being allowed. The location of the mine was deep in the heart of very rugged mountains, and all possible was done to maintain the utmost harmony. Nada and Rex used every opportunity to make me acquainted with the camp, and everywhere it was plainly evident that Rayburn was much loved by his men. The entire atmosphere was one of harmonious cooperation, and there was a total absence of all coarse or undesirable elements. It was Rayburn's custom to pay every man a bonus of $1 a day as long as any rich strike lasted. He made Bob Singleton a superintendent, for he was a fine, noble, upright, honest chap with splendid ability. We spent a wonderful day going through the concentrating plant, from which only the concentrates were shipped to the smelter. Most of the richer gold was free milling, being run into bullion and shipped direct to the mint in Denver. That night at dinner, Daniel Rayburn, in speaking of Bob Singleton, said, "I have long wanted to make Singleton our superintendent, for I feel that he is a man that can be absolutely trusted. I think we had better not go into the mine until he returns from San Francisco, which will probably be the second day after tomorrow. In the meantime, we can trace the surface outcropping and surveys. I want both of you boys to become familiar with the boundaries and all departments of the mine. I will show you the principal veins of ore at the surface. While we have had this mine for about 12 years, yet you will see as you go over it that we have really only explored a small part, although we have taken out millions of dollars in value." Singleton returned late in the afternoon of the fourth day, and plans were made to go carefully through the underground workings the day following. During that evening, I felt as if I were being tremendously charged with a dynamic electrical current. Nada had brought her Arabic musical instrument, and she and Rex entertained us royally after dinner. At 9 o'clock the next morning, we went to the shaft house and met Singleton, who was waiting there, ready to take us into the mine. We entered the cage and descended to the 400-foot level. Here we went through various tunnels and crosscuts. As we were going through one tunnel that led to the southwest, I suddenly felt an electrical current pass through me. I stopped and, turning to Singleton, said, "What does this formation contain toward the north at this point?" "There's only country rock," he replied, "between these two veins. They are about 400 feet apart at the surface, with apparently very little dip." We started to pass on, but without the others seeing me, I marked the place with blue chalk. We then went to the 600-foot level and continued to go through the various workings. I came to a tunnel leading to the southwest, and almost under the spot where I had felt the current 200 feet above, I felt it again, but more powerful than before. I looked to my right and saw an intense blue light with a center of molten gold. This stood out clear and bright upon the wall of the tunnel. I marked the spot quickly, and at the same moment my inner sight was greatly quickened. I saw clearly through the rock what seemed to be a great cavity between the two main veins, at least 200 feet apart. The opening was fully 200 feet high and nearly the same in circumference. A stringer or crack in the formation led into the top, just about the 400-foot level. During an ancient volcanic activity, the ore had been forced to this point, forming very rich veins, but this crevice had allowed it to pour through, filling the cavity. It was one of those strange things that happen in nature, very seldom, of course, but nevertheless they do occur. The whole activity had been flashed on my consciousness in a moment, as all truly cosmic flashes do occur. I marked the spot, then went on with the others to examine the new strike. It was tremendously interesting. The two walls of the vein had suddenly widened in their formation, and at that point, the large body of ore had been created. But it was not more than a tenth as large as the one I had marked. Just at this time, Bob Singleton was called away by one of his men, and I had a chance to explain to Rex and his father what I had been shown by Saint Germain. I knew positively it was by his power that I had been enabled to see within the formation and mark its location. Rayburn decided immediately to have a cross-cut tunnel run in from the spot I had marked to contact the ore body that had been revealed to me. When Singleton returned, Rayburn gave the order to have the men start work at once on this cross-cut. The superintendent looked at him in perfect amazement. However, none of his men ever thought of questioning anything he suggested, and Bob began making arrangements at once to carry out the order. Rayburn did give him a little explanation by saying, "Bob, I know you do not understand why I am having this done, but when this special work is accomplished, I will explain." "Mr. Rayburn," said Singleton, with a gentle, humble dignity, "it will always be my pleasure to carry out your orders without question." "I wish," continued Rayburn, "you had put the most rapid and trustworthy men on this part of the work. Use 3 shifts and finish it as quickly as possible." "How many feet can the men break down in 24 hours?" I asked the superintendent. "I think at least 10 feet," he replied, "more or less, according to the hardness of the rock. At that rate, I felt they would be able to reach the ore body in about 10 days, and I could have almost shouted for joy, because I knew there was no uncertainty about what they would find when they reached it." Rex and I liked Bob Singleton very much, for he seemed a man of fine, strong character, though very young for the type of position he held. He left us as soon as we came out of the mine, for there was a shipment of ore to be sent out that afternoon. "I have wired the foreman at the ranch," Rayburn explained, "that we will not return for 2 weeks unless something vitally important demands it, because I wish to stay here and watch the progress of the new cross-cut tunnel." The days passed quickly, the work went steadily ahead, and we occupied our time writing, hiking, and enjoying the music that Nada and Rex gave us on the Arabian instrument, Bob Singleton joining us at dinner several times. The work on the tunnel cut through 48 feet the first 5 days. Each of the men received a bonus of $1 a foot and Singleton $50 for the good work accomplished. Bob asked Nada and Rex if they would sing for the men one evening while at the camp. They both agreed, and Nada, as a surprise for everybody, wired to Denver for Arabic costumes, and when they appeared for their first number, the men almost went wild with joy. The program closed, and one of the men arose and asked if they might all shake hands with the children in gratitude for the evening's wonderful entertainment. The children agreed, and said afterwards that they had never felt such inspiration or such power in their voices. Both felt the Master Saint Germain had been present, and used the opportunity to pour his radiation through the music to the men, thus raising their consciousness and loyalty to a still greater height. This was his way of neutralizing the influence that had attempted to enter through Gray, which had been unable to accomplish its nefarious purpose. At 12 o'clock on the 11th day, I was in the office of the mine with Bob Singleton, when a man came rushing in, greatly excited, saying they had struck rich ore in the new crosscut. The superintendent looked at me, utterly speechless, So plainly did he show his surprise. It was then I realized that he had never really dreamed of finding ore in the new workings. Merely by the use of ordinary geological observations, this ore body never would have been located, for geologists seldom take into consideration the freakish formations that sometimes occur in nature, and that she does occasionally extraordinary things. This deposit would never have been found except by the superhuman power of our beloved master. Singleton asked me to find Rex and his father and tell them the news. I hurried to the camp quarters and found them awaiting me at lunch. When I told of what had happened, we all silently gave praise and thanks to the mighty I Am Presence and our blessed Saint Germain for making this rich strike possible. Rayborn sent word to Bob that we would be ready to go with him and examine the new discovery at 1:30. Nada decided to await our report. When we reached the spot, I saw the last shots had broken well into the ore body, as the entire face of the tunnel was in ore. Bob instructed Daniel Rayborn sample this strike and push the work as fast as possible that we may determine its extent. "I will," Bob replied, and went on to explain. "The formation in the ore deposit itself is much more easily drilled and broken than the ordinary rock." As we returned to the surface, he could stand it no longer and burst forth, "Mr. Rayborn, this is the most remarkable thing I have ever read or heard of in all my life. How did you know the ore was there? No outer signs indicated it." "Bob, my boy," he replied, "have patience. You will soon know. We shall prolong our stay another 10 days, and if I am not mistaken, they will make twice the speed in the ore body itself as they did getting to it. Keep this ore entirely separate from all the rest in the mine. I will explain the reason why later." That evening at dinner, Mr. Rayborn asked Nada, Rex, and myself to meet with him at 8:00. "I suggest," he began, as soon as we were all seated, "that we take Bob Singleton into partnership with us as general manager of the entire mine, including what in the future will be known as the Master Discovery. I think he had better select an assistant of whom we shall approve. I feel certain he can be trusted as one of us. We have every evidence before us that all our beloved master said of the ore body is physically true. However, let us say nothing to Bob of this until the tunnel drift is through." The following days were filled with great activity and tremendous interest as the work progressed. Almost every evening, Bob was invited to dine with us that all might become better acquainted. 20 days after the ore body was reached, the tunnel drift was through to the opposite side, a distance of fully 200 feet, and Rayborn was more than happy that we had waited to learn the extent of it. The evening the tunnel was finished, he announced at dinner that Bob was to be taken in as one of the partners, and while the Master Discovery really belonged to Nada and Rex, they wanted him to share a certain specified interest in the mine in addition to his salary. Then he explained how the ore body came to be discovered. He gave a short description of our beloved Master Saint Germain, telling of the protection he and his family had been given for years, of the recent attempt upon his life and his escape. Tears of gratitude and joy streamed down Bob's cheeks as he tried to express his appreciation. "Your deep feeling," said Rayborn, "proves your sincerity to me beyond question. We shall all feel a great love for you, Bob, and I am certain you can be trusted as one of us." "I thank each of you," said Bob with sincerity, "and I will do my best to prove worthy and true to the trust you place in me, and for your very great kindness." It was then we learned that Bob had a sister, Pearl, of whom he was very fond and who was his only living relative, with the exception of an aunt with whom she lived. "I expect Pearl," he continued, "to reach here tomorrow, as she is coming on to visit me for a time." He was very enthusiastic in his praise of her, and drew forth her picture from his pocket. She was about 18, remarkably good-looking, and yet one felt she had a tremendous strength of character, with a natural sense of poise and command. He told Daniel Rayborn of the desire he always had to provide the means for her university training, and with his recent good fortune of sharing in the mine, this became possible of accomplishment. The following day, Nada, Rex, Bob, and I drove to the station to meet Pearl. As the train stopped and the passengers were alighting, we saw someone rush into Bob's arms. Made us realize how dearly they loved each other. That evening, Bob told her of his new interest in the mine and the good fortune that had come to him. Later, when she met Daniel Rayburn, she threw her arms about him and kissed him in deep gratitude for his kindness to Bob. She tried to thank him, but he said, "My child, it gives me still greater happiness to know you are to share the joy with your brother, whom we all have learned to love." That evening, we spent listening to Nada and Rex sing, and I think Pearl was, without question, the happiest, most grateful person I have ever seen. The next day came a message from the ranch saying Daniel Rayburn was needed there, so we made preparations to leave the second morning following. The assistant superintendent, whom Bob had chosen to help him, was to arrive at the camp 10 days later, and Nada persuaded Bob to let Pearl go back to the ranch with her until he had time to visit with her. Rayburn planned to stay at the ranch only 2 or 3 weeks and then return to the mine again. At 6 o'clock on the day of our departure, all the men who were off duty came to see us off, and as Bob said goodbye, he held Pearl in his strong, fond embrace and expressed his gratitude that she had found so wonderful a friend in Nada. Rex and I took turns in driving that Daniel Rayburn might have a chance to become better acquainted with Nada's newly found friend. We noticed Pearl was a very close observer, and her appreciation of the beautiful scenery we drove through was very deep. Time passes rapidly when all is joy and harmony, and this is one of the great laws of life. If humanity would but comprehend the imperative need for its operation in their lives, and understand the vital factor it becomes in their conscious youth, we would be living in a most marvelous world more quickly than we can possibly realize now. We made a long detour while returning, but arrived home at 8 o'clock, ready for the splendid dinner that awaited us. We all seemed a little tired by the long drive, except Pearl. The newness of the scenes kept her interest so aroused, she seemed not to feel anything but the great happiness of the experience. We retired early, deeply grateful to the mighty I Am Presence for the wonderful blessings it had bestowed upon us.